You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
That heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble and drum. Beat out old trouble and drum. Beat out old trouble and drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Kick him out the door.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The world's greatest producer, Kelly Whitworth, is with us once again. How art thou, Kelly?
I'm going well, Joe.
I've been looking for dirt about you, what you've been doing this week.
I'm clean. I'm all washed. I had a shower morning.
Yeah.
No dirt on me.
No dirt on you, all right. But I understand there's a... one of those horrible music festivals coming up in Queenscliff in Victoria, which you're going to.
Yeah, I'm doing a bit of volunteering as well as we've got a 3CR media pass.
Oh, that's a freebie, is it?
Well, we've been promoting the festival throughout certain programs.
Yeah, and not this program, I can assure you.
Not this one. Well, you're doing it right now, though.
That was the whole point. All right. Poor old Nick Southall will be wondering what this is all about. How are you, young Nick?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Good. Joe, how
good.
Are you?
Good. Your mate didn't tell you how we grilled him last week, did he?
Yeah, look, I listened to it. So
what's in store.
Look, I have some idea, sure.
Yeah, because, you know, you've got a book here. Look, I'll tell you what I hate and what Radical Australia, we don't promote shit, all right?
Yeah.
You've given me a book to look at, which I've looked at. It's a great book, but I don't promote things until the end of the interview. You got to earn your bickies. It's like the Salvation Army. You come in for a meal, you listen to the spiel about God, and then you get your meal. You've got it, have you?
Sure. Look, I'm happy to talk about anything, really.
Well, it's actually about you, I'm afraid.
Look, yeah. I'm happy to talk about myself.
Good, because that'll give us an idea of why you did this.
And welcome, Nick. That was a pretty full-on introduction. And
well, you know,
I just want to say welcome and thanks for joining us on the Blower from Wollongong.
Yeah, look, thank you, Kelly. Yeah.
Yeah, look, Kelly's very nice. She's always trying to get these artistic types and novelists on the program who are only interested in telling us about their latest things and they can make a buck. But looking at this book, there's no way you're going to make a buck out of this. It's to actually inform people. It's called Disaster Communism and Anarchy in the Streets. I hope you know the definition of anarchy, young Nick.
Sorry?
I hope you know the definition of anarchy.
Look, I think for me anarchy is a whole range of different things, as is communism.
All right. Okay. We'll leave it at that at the minute, but we'll grill you at the end. Now, what year were you born?
1962.
Just a youngster, 62, 6 years before May 68. So, were you born in Australia?
So, I was born in Warsaw, England. So, that's a sort of an outer suburb of Birmingham these days, but it used to be a poor town outside of Birmingham previously when I was born there.
Really? You haven't got much of an accent. When did you come here?
Look, I came out here in 74, so I've been here quite a while.
You got any recollections about life in Birmingham or just outside Birmingham?
Look, I was born in Warsaw because my parents had been studying and my dad was just about to get a job in Sheffield and my mum's parents lived in Warsaw. So she came there to have me, but that was pretty much it. I'd spent some time with my grandparents, but I didn't spend a lot of time in Warsaw. I grew up in Sheffield in England.
Right, so what, you grew up with your grandparents or...?
Parents? No, with my parents in Sheffield. My dad got a job there. And we moved there, in my first year, and that's where I grew up, spent the first 11 years of my life.
Right. And are your parents still alive?
Yes, they're both still alive. They're both, I'm here in Wollongong, and they're both here in different aged care centres. No longer together, they're both, in aged care now.
In aged care. And have you got any siblings?
Yeah, I've got a brother who's also here in Wollongong. Right. So we all came out together, obviously, as a family, and, we're all still here in Wollongong.
So what was your upbringing like in England for the first 11 years of your life?
Well, it was... I mean, I really enjoyed my childhood. Mm. And so we lived on the outskirts of Sheffield in what felt to me like a village. And I went to the local school, which was connected to the local Church of England church, an old, very old church. We used to walk through the cemetery, the church every morning. My parents weren't like religious. They were communists.
Right,
so
right.
It was just the local school. But it was an idyllic childhood in many ways. And at the same time, I had communist parents. And so we were often going to protest and involved in political struggles, going to meetings the like. So it was both a strained but exciting childhood in that sense as well.
It's interesting, they were they a member of the Communist Party or were they a member of another breakaway group? Do you remember?
No, they were both members of the Communist Party of Great Britain. As was my grandmother.
Right. A dynasty, as they say.
It ran deep in the family,
So the Hungarian disaster and the Czech revolt in 68 really didn't really affect their belief system?
Look, my dad was pretty much a Stalinist, he was fairly keen he grew to love the Soviet Union, firstly, in the war because of the role the Soviet Union played in defeating fascism during the war my parents both grew up, as children during the war. My dad had to be evacuated out of Birmingham during the Blitz, and his mother was bombed in the Birmingham small arms factory, and both my grandfathers went off to fight fascism. And so, yes, he was fairly forgiving of the... mistakes, let's call them crimes, of the Soviet Union and its leadership. Mum was more critical, but stayed in the CPGB, and then when they came out here in the Communist Party of Australia, because they felt they had an independent line on some things, and there was room to debate and argue and disagree.
Yeah, was there much debate as a child when you were... over the dinner table or the lunch table or whatever?
Sure. I mean, it was politics all the time. Everything was considered to be political, especially by my mother, who was a teacher at the time, and, was keen to teach her own children about the world and what she thought felt about it and how it needed changing and what was wrong with it. And, we were going to a lot of things, like the Vietnam War was really important to us. I learned to walk, really, letterboxing Vietnam War atrocity pamphlets to local housing commission estates and so forth. So, yeah, look, it was, and there was a lot. We were always, well, often around people who politics was their life, and so yes, there was. It was part of everyday life.
Did they ever get to some of those East European music festivals that used to be held by various communist states for people in the West, supporters in the West?
Well, because my dad was an academic, he actually went over to East Germany twice to teach summer schools. So the whole family went over to East Germany, and we spent time there.
So you went to East Germany. How old were you, do you think?
Look, I was about 7 or 8. Like, we went twice in a row. So yeah, about maybe 9 at the most. Yeah, those sort of, you know, late '60s it was.
Yeah. Any recollections about your time in East Germany?
Sure, I remember going, and I remember because I befriended a family at one of the summer schools, a young, you know, student family, and they took me to stay in Berlin with them without my parents or my brother, and so I got to spend some time, I think it was a week, in East Berlin without them, and so I do remember it made quite an impression on me, and it was a very different place to England. There was a lot of tension in East Berlin, and a lot of military and police around, and you know, you felt that there was a sort of worry of confrontation. You know, I'd grown up in England post-war, so Germany had a special place in England's imaginary of what, you know, about the war and so forth, and so it made quite an impression on me that things could potentially kick off again, it felt like. And I had some sense of the Cold War, you know, and that communism was the enemy of a lot of people I sort of was growing up with, and the movies and the TV news and so forth. So I had some sense of that too. So, you know, trying to work out, like, okay, what is this world I'm coming into, you know, where we're at war, and the enemy of a lot of the people I know are the communists, and we're communists, and that sort of thing.
Right. How did that make you feel as a young lad?
Look, it made me feel vulnerable, really. I felt like there was a possibility that at some stage they might come for the communists.
Right.
And, you know, my parents were communists, my grandmother was a communist, a lot of the people I knew, adults I knew and so forth, were communists, so I felt like that could happen. And that made me worry about, well, you never knew when that might happen. And so, I felt vulnerable for myself, but also more so, I suppose, for the people around me and the people I loved and so forth.
Right. Did your parents pay a personal price for their beliefs in terms of their careers, your father as an academic and your mother as a teacher?
No, I don't think so, really. I think with some people they did, and in some ways they did, but in sort of, especially in North England where we were, the CPGB, class struggle, Marxism and so forth were quite popular.
Right.
So I felt like it didn't hold them back a great deal. So, sure, in some ways, absolutely, but in general, I think not so much.
Yeah, so what field was your father in as an academic?
So English literature was what he specialised in.
And your mum, what was she teaching?
Well, she was teaching school. She was a school teacher until she came out to Australia, and she became an academic here because they made her do the Diploma of Education when she got out here because she didn't have that. So she had to go back to university to learn to be a teacher.
Right.
And when she'd finished that, they offered her the job teaching the Diploma of Education because she was that good at it.
Well, let's show your parents a bit of respect. What are their names?
So my mum's name is Nina Southall, and my dad is Ray Southall.
Right. Well, all the best to both of them. And obviously they've done a great job with you. I don't know about your brother because I haven't spoken to him. Is he a bit of a tearaway, your brother?
look, we were both tearaways. They did bring us up as rebels and, you know, revolutionaries, really. And we revolted against them.
That's the way it is, isn't it? Hopefully you didn't become an accountant or a... a priest or an Anglican priest or something.
No, he's still a communist and a different type of communist to me.
Right.
So we argue a lot about politics when we do argue about it.
Yes.
He didn't do the opposite.
Now I'm going to ask you a very embarrassing question. Are you 10-pound poms, and were you kind of whinging? You know, English trade, you know, shop stewards. That's what I want to know.
So, no.
So you paid your own way. That's unusual.
Well, we did. We weren't 10-pound poms. We were more expensive. We didn't make our own way.
Uh-huh.
The University of Wollongong employed Dad and paid for us to come out. So that cost them a fair bit more than £10.
Right.
Dad did help to convert the staff association, which was what academics were in when he arrived, into a union at the university. So yes, he was both a whinging pom and a trade union organizer.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, the labels we put on different groups of people as they come into this country. It's been something we've done forever and ever and continue to do, unfortunately. So your father was headhunted by Wollongong University.
Well, he applied for the job.
He applied for the job,
he got it, and so they part of the deal was that they would pay for you to come out.
So what made them... I mean, he would have been, what, he'd be in his late 30s, early 40s, wouldn't he, when he came across?
Yeah, late 30s, yeah, something like that,
What made him uproot him and your mum? What made Nina and your dad, what made them uproot the whole life and come out here? Did Granny come with you or did she stay behind? Or
No, it was just us. But he'd always dreamed of the South Seas. You know, he had this romantic dream of coming to the South Seas since he was a teenager. And he was the one who really wanted to come, and he wanted to get out of what he was doing, but also he wanted to get out of Britain. Things were pretty grim, and, yeah, he just wanted adventure, I suppose,
Right. So what year did you arrive as a family?
74.
You know that longing for the South Seas has got a historical background. I mean, when the English first started exploring and colonising, a lot of the ordinary seafarers used to abscond from the ships because the lifestyle they could have on the South Sea Islands regarding relationships and food was 100 times better than what they expected in England. It was a huge issue. So that concept that somehow the South Seas were this idyllic paradise kind of continued to reverberate in English society. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, both of my parents grew up in basically slums. Dad in Small Heath, where, you know, Peaky Blinders is set, and you know that my mum's family didn't have running water in the house when she was a child, and they both grew up very poor. And so, yes, dreams of idyllic, you know, islands in the Pacific, I'm sure were part of the sort of lore of some escape from that.
Yeah, like kind of when they came back, you know, generation to generation. So you get here in 74 and you're still in primary school, I assume?
Yeah, just one year of primary school.
And did you have a hard time that year, that last year in primary school in Wollongong?
Yeah, I did. I found it really difficult. I was in shock, culture shock.
Right. 74 was all right. You know, I was, what, 25 then? That was all right. Well, for us it was. I don't know about you, Mob.
Well, that's right. It was a shock to be a Pommy bastard, which I, you know, was made clear to me that that's what I was when I arrived. And then the culture at the school, especially, was quite different. So I'd never encountered corporal punishment before, but there was a lot of caning at the school.
You didn't go to some type of religious school, did you?
No, I went to just the local state school. But there was no corporal punishment there.
Rite of passage. Rite of passage in those days, corporal punishment, the strap, the cane, the hand, the bum, the back of the legs. Where did you get it?
Look, on the hand, I mean, I didn't get it until high school, but then in high school I was fairly rebellious and so I got it a lot, as did, you know, a lot of other people.
Yeah, so where did you go to high school?
So Wollongong High.
So were you able to fit in or were you still a Pommy bastard as far as people were concerned?
Look, I managed to fit in to a certain extent. I mean, it wasn't so much when I was at high school, it wasn't so much being a Pommy bastard. Increasingly, I was a troublemaker.
Uh-huh.
I rebelled against the school. And then as I became, you know, from 13 on, I became clearer in myself that I was a communist and that I wanted to bring the system down, including the school and the education system. That endeared me to some students who were also very critical of what was going on around them, but obviously made it difficult for some of my friends and also made me sort of an outsider for a lot of others.
You forgot the great Australian saying, don't put your head above the parapet. And obviously you put your head above the parapet, you come from England, you're a troublemaker. Look, I understand, I agree, you should have had corporal punishment. If it was me, I'd use a cane on the back of your legs, mate. Can't have troublemakers like you coming to this country and ruining it.
Well, there was a lot of caning.
Yeah, I know there was in those days. So during high school, you defined yourself as a communist. What did you believe or feel communism was at that stage?
So I suppose I thought it was where workers controlled the means of production, where there weren't bosses, where people had more of a say over, you know, their own lives. Those sorts of things, the sort of traditional Marxism. You know, I joined the young communist movement, I think, when I was 13, and the first thing we did was read the Communist Manifesto, and obviously I'd had an education, a communist education from my parents and my family and from other comrades that I'd met, but at that stage it was more of a formal education in the communist classics and the basics of Marxism and so forth, and so I thought in those sort of traditional terms.
You didn't think of it some type of religious experience, did you?
I wasn't keen on religion.
You weren't keen on that old bearded bloke in the sky. I bet you didn't even believe in him.
No, indeed.
Right. Troublemaker. All right. At the end, did you get to year 12?
No, I didn't. I made it to year 10. Right. I didn't spend much of year 10 at school, but I sort of got my school certificate, which was your sort of what you got at the end of year 10, grudgingly from the school.
Right. Well, if they didn't give it to you, you'd stay another year and make life hell for them.
Indeed. I think that was their logic. Give it to him and show him the door.
Exactly.
And so I left school. I'd pretty much left before that, but, you know, I formally left school at the end of year 10 and joined the Communist Party proper when I turned 16. They wouldn't let me join before I was 16, but once I was 16, which was the end of that year, I could join the party, and then I went to work for the party.
You actually went to work for the party? That was your first paid job?
Well, it wasn't paid.
So
I went on the dole, and I was basically a full-time volunteer for the next couple of years, working as an assistant to the local Communist Party organiser.
Right. Did you feel that the tensions which were appearing in the Communist Party at that stage?
Look, I think I was aware of them to a certain extent, but I was very enthusiastic, and what I was focusing on more was, okay, this is my opportunity to learn how to be a revolutionary, which is what I wanted to do with my life. And so...
That's an interesting vocation for a 16-year-old, isn't it? Learn to how to be a revolutionary. I like that.
Yeah, look, I went to my guidance counsellor sometime during that year, last year at school, and they sort of did an aptitude test, and they said, oh, we think you should, you know, go on and do tertiary education and whatever. Yeah. And they said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be a revolutionary. And they said, well, no one's going to pay you to do that. And I said, well, I know, but that's what I want to do.
Well, fair enough. What did you think a revolutionary was?
Look, somebody who helped to organise the demolition of capitalism and the creation of a socialist or communist society in its place.
Right. So how long did this fantasy last for before you got some paid employment?
Look, paid employment, it lasted quite a long time before I was basically on the dole for many years.
Right.
I did a lot of different
types of work. Now, look, I'm going to have to take you. I'm going to have to take you apart here, mate. We don't use the word dole here. What we use is social security system.
Yep.
Yeah, we were paying you something so you wouldn't actually become a revolutionary. You were part of the social security system. There's no such thing as the dole. You're part of the social security system, all right?
Okay, if you prefer.
Well, it's true. There's no such thing as a dole act. It's the Social Security Act.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. I prefer that because the other ones have got negative connotations, you know, but Social Security is very nice, you know. We give you something so you don't starve and revolt, and you stay quiet.
Well, it didn't work.
Well, what happened? What did you do?
Well, apart from, you know, initially being a you know, basically a full-time organiser for the Communist Party, then I went on to become a unemployed organiser, so helped to establish a local unemployed union.
Now, hang on. You've never had a paid job and you start up an unemployment union?
Yeah.
All right, I'm not going to talk about that. There's some irony there, but go on.
at the time, there was mass youth unemployment.
That's correct,
50,
yes. Tell us, it was about 30%, and especially Wollongong and places
Wollongong
like that.
Wollongong was closer to 50%, youth unemployment. No. And then there was the mass sacking. So 1982, they started mass sackings in the steel and coal industry. And so unemployment was the issue of the time. And that year, 1982, I was involved in the sort of famous Kamira strike where coal miners occupied their pit, the storming of Parliament by unemployed and soon-to-be unemployed workers.
Yeah, you broke that parliamentary glass door. I remember it so clearly, so many years later.
That's right. It was. I was there heaving. And then
you were one of the ones heaving. Has anybody sent you a bill? I wouldn't make this public admission on Community Radio 3CR, mate. This program's podcast.
Yeah, that's fine. They can come and get me.
All right. So how long does this unemployed activism last for?
So, well, we established Wollongong out of Workers' Union in late 1982, and then in 1983 we occupied a house opposite the Department of Social Security, and we held that house for almost 6 years.
Right.
So I was basically a full-time unemployed activist in that union for the whole time of its existence.
So did your parents think you were a lost cause by then, or they supported you in your endeavours?
Look, my dad was very upset when I left school and wasn't happy with me choosing to be unemployed, or even though I was doing party work and so forth. My mum was more supportive. But it was when the Out of Workers Union became a really important organisation in local struggles that I think they both decided I was not a lost cause and that what I was doing was really quite important.
Well, and, obviously they trained you for this since you were a little kiddie. And there you were, letterboxing at the age of 3 or 4.
They did, indeed. So it was a bit weird when they were, you know, especially when my dad was upset.
Well, he was thinking, how's the boy going to make a living? You can't live on Social Security for the rest of your life. Look, it's 4:30. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR. Kelly Whitworth, the world's greatest producer, is doing all the things to keep this program on air. Our friend Nick is answering all my impertinent questions. And we're halfway through the torture, Nick. So when did you finally get paid employment? That's what I want to know.
Look, I had bits and pieces. I've never had a full-time job.
Excuse me, how old are you?
I'm 62.
How much is in your superannuation account, mate?
Oh, not enough to survive on.
You're not relying on your parents' inheritance or something?
No, I'm working now, but I've worked as an academic now UOW and some other universities.
Now, hang on. I'm a bit confused. You leave school at year 10 and now you're a bloody academic in the university. How did that happen? Did you bribe somebody or did you actually go back to school?
Look, I did a welfare after the end of the Out of Workers Union. I ended up doing a welfare certificate in the early 1990s. Which eventually got me into university in the early 2000s. So in the early 2000s, I was given an ultimatum by Centrelink, work for the Dole or further education.
Right.
And I decided to go to university.
I think we'll go to Kelly for a minute. Kelly's been through a similar experience.
I just love that Centrelink ultimatum. Like it's a cultural phenomenon.
That's how Kelly came to 3CR, I think. Is that right?
I was at uni.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get any ultimatum.
You didn't get any ultimatum?
No,
in the Centrelink.
I came here.
You're a goody
willingly.
Two shoes.
I don't know about that, but yeah. I never received some ultimatum.
Right. Well, you should have gone for work for the Dole, mate. You could have organised the dispossessed and the marginalised, Nick.
Look, I seriously considered it, and I talked about it with my partner. We had two children at the time, and we'd been living in poverty for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I did want to do that. Mm-hmm. But my partner was keen on me finding some way of making some money.
Well, you got kids to look after, mate.
Come on. That's right.
Grow up.
Right. Yeah.
I assume that's what you were saying to you. Grow up, Nick. We need food on the table.
Something like more food.
On the table. All right, okay. So you went to university and what did you do?
So I did a BA.
In what? Bachelor of Arts.
Politics and sociology were my majors.
Right. Was this pre or post fees?
So, no, this is fees, yeah. No, fees. This is early 2000.
So you're dirt poor, you go to university, you do a politics course.
Yeah.
And you've got to pay fees for it. I love it. Okay. Yep. All right. What did that lead to?
So I did my honours.
Honours in what?
So I did my honours. I did my thesis on the Wollongong Out of Workers Union.
Right. Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Called it Working for the Class, which was about the fight for the right to work and work refusal. It was sort of dealing with those issues of how can we do communist work rather than capitalist work, basically. How can we do that?
So are you saying collectivist work in comparison to private investment for private profit work, or what do you mean communist work?
Well, working to try and create communism as much as possible and demolish capitalism as much as possible.
Yeah, but what's your definition of communism? I mean, we all understand what capitalism is. It's private investment for private profit ideology, but now that you're a little bit older, what's your definition, or what do you think it should be?
Well, one of the things, and again, I sort of mentioned before, I think it's a whole range of different things, but one of the things I talk about in that thesis is the idea that communism is when people have control over what they do, how they do it, and why they do it.
Right.
So basically, people individually and collectively able to control their own lives.
Right. That wouldn't be a kind of a major kind of acceptance, would there, as far as communism is concerned? That definition, is it all encompassing, or is it something that you've come to over a lifetime?
Well, it's something I've come to via sort of libertarian communist theory and practice.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's I was a traditional Marxist for many years, and then I went to the Soviet Union in 1990, just before it collapsed.
And what was how long were you there for?
Look, I was there as a representative of the Socialist Party in Australia.
Right.
And I was a guest of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And I was there for 5 weeks.
And what was that like? Because at that critical juncture, as far as the Soviet Union was concerned, were you just in Moscow, or did you get outside Moscow?
Well, I spent a little while in Moscow and then some time in Yalta in the Crimea.
Right.
At a Communist Party sanatorium in Yalta on the Black Sea.
As all the guests tend to do, used to do anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there was lots of international delegations there, and then people from the Central Committee of the Soviet Party, and delegations from all over the place, and worker heroes of labour, and all sorts of, you know, people there.
Right.
It was very interesting and very instructive, and changed me forever. And
how did it change you forever?
Well, it made me totally rethink what I thought communism was and what the history of communism.
Right.
And, they used to call it real existing socialism.
Right. So, what was the thing that actually forced you to reconsider a lifetime of thinking? Was there a specific kind of issue or a specific experience, or was it just the whole 5 weeks you just didn't feel quite happy with the situation?
Well, I'd always been critical of a whole range of things to do with traditional Marxism, traditional communism, the Soviet Union, et cetera, but actually going there and immersing myself in the misery, the tension, the contradictions, the complexities of so-called real existing socialism was really educational and forced me to really think much more deeply about those contradictions and complexities, and have a good hard look at myself and at the cause as I understood it, and made me rethink.
Were you surprised at how rapidly it all collapsed?
Look, once I was there, I had to give a report back to the party when I came back, and I said, look, it's over, it's all over, and they're like, you know, most people were like, oh, they've been through difficult periods in the past, and you're catastrophizing, you're overstating it, et cetera, et cetera. And within a year, the Soviet Union didn't exist, right?
Totally
it was clear.
Yeah.
It was clear. It was the place was already, you know, so destabilized and chaotic, and nobody knew what was going on really, and apart from maybe, you know, some people who think people like Putin and the like, you know.
Yeah, I was quite I wasn't surprised by the collapse, but what I was surprised by, because we had contacts in the Soviet Union, which we were in regular contact with, what I was surprised by was the fact that people had that once-in-a-lifetime chance to continue on a collectivist pathway or go on or allow these oligarchs to take over all these collective enterprises, and there was hardly any resistance to the takeover of massive enterprises that had been collectivized for decades. That's what really surprised me. Did that surprise you, or you expected it, the whole thing to disintegrate?
Yeah, look, my analysis at the time was that what would replace the existing system would be something closer to fascism.
Right.
Well,
it looks like your analysis is pretty good.
And you could see those forces were the ones who were sort of planning for the transformation. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who actually, people like Putin, right, who had institutional power within the old state, who were going to use that in really vicious, brutal ways to ensure that they were the new ruling class. And you could see that happening. And the people who wanted the best, and most people I met wanted socialism. They not what they had, but something that was more like what they thought of was real socialism, and they wanted things to be better. They knew the system as it existed couldn't last, it had to go, and most of them wanted something better, but it was clear that that wasn't going to be the case. And, yeah, it was incredibly disturbing at the time, and you know, more so for the poor people who were going to be paying the price. And things were quite terrible there, but you knew things were going to get worse.
Right. So what you expected was going to happen has happened? Is that what you would say today?
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, I'm looking at this little booklet. I wouldn't call it a book. What is it, Nick? How many pages is it? Where am I? 142 pages.
Yeah.
It's called Disaster, Communism, and Anarchy in the Streets. And then it's got all these little pictures at the bottom. I mean, I know this is, and at the top, this is radio. You've got a fire, you've got waves, you've got what looks like a Sputnik, you've got a cloud and lightning, a bomb, a house, a whirlwind, hands clasping the Milan anarchist sign from 1968, a boat with an oar, a heart, the old hammer, but no sickle, but a spanner, a house with a tree and a plant. Why those images on the front of this book called Disaster, Communism and Anarchy in the Streets?
So it's interesting. We had quite a discussion about the cover. The person who designed the book, the cover, and did the layout, a beautiful layout with all the pictures and everything, did a great job, Jeremy Kay. They presented us with, because it was put together by a collective. I wrote it, but we put it together as a collective.
So who's we? Who's we? What's the collective?
So Alexander, who you interviewed a couple of weeks ago, his partner, Mel Barnes, Jeremy Kay, who did the layout and design and so forth, and Mark Gorn, who does the foreword in the book, and myself.
Did you have any particular ideological perspective or agreement with this particular collective, or is it a collective that came together to put these ideas into print?
Well, we're friends and comrades. Most of us a few of us have worked together for many years, some of us for a less amount of time, but still for, you know, some time. Mm-hmm. We have different politics, but we're all revolutionaries, we're all anti-capitalists. Some of us, you know, would, I think, cons- consider ourselves more communist than anarchist, but, you know, there's a broad spectrum there.
A broad spectrum, right. Perspective. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Now, obviously, there's chapters. What's disaster communism? I mean, I think a lot of our listeners wouldn't have any idea what disaster communism is. What's the definition of disaster communism?
Sure. So, well, it's a term I came up with some time ago in response to basically reading Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine,
right,
and her popularization of the term disaster capitalism. And I was thinking about that term, and when I started writing in 2011 about disasters, I was trying to think of a term that encapsulated the opposite of disaster capitalism. And so I coined the term disaster communism to basically try and, I'm describing how ordinary people at a grassroots level, individually and in communities, collectively, organise alternatives to disaster capitalism. So when disasters strike, how they take control of their own lives, organise to deal with the disaster, but also the disasters that are created by disaster capitalism, those who seek to exploit disasters to increase exploitation and repression and so forth.
You're kidding. You're kidding that people exploit disasters to increase repression? What planet do you live on? I mean, a great confabulator. You've taken a leaf out of his book, haven't you? He doesn't.
Sorry,
I said the great confabulator, the president-elect of the US of R. You've taken a leaf out of his book, you know?
Well, he is a classic example of, the disaster capitalist.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's brilliant. It's got to be brilliant. What I love about the American elections, I don't cry, I always laugh, was the fact that we've got the exploited now joining the exploiters to exploit the marginalised. I love it. Now, getting back to this book, you mentioned that it was a blog. You had a blog. What do you mean you got a blog?
Yeah, so once I'd finished my PhD...
Hang on. What was your PhD on? Don't tell me it was the unemployed struggle in Wollongong.
No, it was on contemporary communist theory. So I studied the strategic vision of Michael Hart and Antonio Negri.
Right, okay. So I think most people would know Antonio Negri. I don't know if they know Michael Hart. Who's Michael Hart?
Well, Michael and Tony wrote Empire, Multitude, Commonwealth. They wrote, some quite famous books that became sort of very influential in the alter-globalisation movement of the 2000s.
Right.
And so that was the sort of time I was thinking, going to university, and I decided I wanted to do my PhD on their strategic vision, a sort of hopefully constructively critical engagement with their strategic vision.
Right. And did you come to any conclusions you can kind of elucidate in the next minute or two?
Well, look, I focused on how they discussed democracy, peace and love. Pardon me. So I agreed with their basic argument, which is what we need within the movements that are challenging and trying to go beyond capitalism and create post-capitalist alternatives is more democracy. We need to think more carefully and clearly about the issue of violence. Center peace and the struggle for peace, and perhaps probably most importantly, we need to think about love and the importance of care within our movements, and how we can build the power of love.
Well, the idea of disasters and people's response to disasters is not all negative, is it? There's a lot of kind of collectivist action which is needed in a disaster for people to survive and even prosper post that disaster. Is that the type of things you're looking at in this book?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the main response that most people respond in incredibly positive ways to disasters, ways that make a lie out of, you know, the sort of general baseline ideology of capitalism and neoliberalism, and people do incredible things, both individually and collectively, to help each other, to support each other, to care for each other, to share what they have, resources, wealth, to redistribute wealth, resources, power, and the, you know, there's many examples, and people can read the book. I've got a whole range of examples of how people do that. And if you pay attention to what happens when disasters occur, you'll see that happening. And that I try and weave sort of the major disasters I look at, you know, fires, floods, the pandemic, etc., with the smaller sort of everyday disasters of capitalism to sort of explore and consider how people react in the best ways to those. So I try and focus on that.
I mean, there's nothing new about this. I mean, remember when Rome burnt and Nero kind of burnt a few hundred Christians, including St. Peter, you know, marginalised, trying to find a marginalised group to blame for the disaster and then profit from it. We see that over and over again with disasters. Now, did you write everything in this book, or there are articles by other authors?
No, I wrote everything in the book.
Everything?
Yeah.
Oh, you actually went to Japan too.
Yes, I did a couple of times.
It says here, live by the river, some thoughts on a brief trip to Japan.
That's right.
You didn't go together, you and your mate I spoke to a few weeks ago, did you?
No, Alexander was there, so I went.
You went there to bum off him, didn't you? Free accommodation.
I did stay with him, and I went there for a conference, and we gave a joint paper at the conference.
Right.
So it was just... it was just after the triple disasters, the earthquake, tsunami, and Fukushima.
Right. And I started on page 133. You write about communes. What do you have to tell us about communes? I think it's the last article in the book.
Yeah, I finished with communes because I think, you know, I wanted to sort of finish by exploring how communism can mean a lot of different things. And so I talk about the idea of the commune and start off with the sort of classic examples, Paris Commune or hippie communes or the communes that exist currently in South America and so forth, and talk about those, but then talk about the struggles that have been occurring, say, in Wollongong and different forms of communes that exist here. And from the, you know, I make an argument that, you know, they can be small number of, you know, people relating to each other. It could be a household, for instance, as a commune, right through to movements as communes and campaigns and struggles as communes. And so I sort of explore the idea of the commune to sort of make that argument that there are a whole range of different forms of disaster communism, how we work communally to deal with disasters, and how we create alternatives to disasters by having a whole range of different communistic ways of relating to each other.
Does Naomi Klein like the use of her term?
I don't know. I haven't heard from Naomi.
I reckon she'd be interested in what you've come up with.
Yeah, it's just the other side of the coin. You got disaster capitalism, you got disaster
but
communism.
But no one else had thought about it before, except for Nick.
No, they have.
Is that right, Nick?
They have.
Well, I mean,
nobody has an original thought, Nick. I'm telling you that now. If you go through history, you'll always find an example.
Look, I use Rebecca Solnit's work, pardon me, at the beginning.
Yes.
And Rebecca doesn't use the term disaster communism, but she's also talking about these things. And yeah, it's not a new idea in the sense that people, ever since there's been disasters and people have been talking about them, they've been talking about disaster communism in a sense as the opposite. But the term itself, and obviously some of the things I talk about, I would say are
original thoughts.
Yep. Original.
Yeah, but why? You've got big letters, disaster, huge, communism, huge, and then in tiny letters, an anarchy in the streets. What do you mean by anarchy in the streets? Do you mean a little bit of chaos or a little bit of cooperation or both?
It's a play on, right? It's a play on the idea, you know, often when we hear anarchy in the streets, it's like, I sort of explain it in the first chapter where, which is called Disaster Communism and Anarchy in the Streets, which right. is based on the first blog post I did about this, where I sort of talk about those sorts of cliched tropes that we have of disasters where people sort of go crazy and trample yeah. over each other and, yeah. and it's all chaos and yeah. everything goes to shit. And
yeah, just what we need, another person misconstruing the word anarchy. Thank you. Thank you very much.
But what I'm saying is that isn't, you know, the,
exactly.
And
yeah.
the opposite happens.
Exactly.
The sort of anarchy that happens is people come together, they yeah. cooperate, they work out how to do things themselves yes. to make things better, and you know, so it's a play on that term.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a simple concept, you know. You either sink or swim. You know, if you live in a society of plenty, competition kind of gets you forward. If you live in a society where there is, there's a crisis, only cooperation gets you forward. That's human history. Now, look, you won't believe this, Nick. We've almost come to an end. Now, I understand that the book is available. It's been published by Kembla Books, Wollongong, New South Wales. So if people want to get a hold of Disaster Communism and Anarchy in the Streets, and I recommend they have a look at it because there's some very good ideas in it, how do they go about it? Have you got a website they can go to or anything like that?
Sure. So KemblaBooks.com is the publisher's website.
Mm-hmm.
So they can find it there. They can also find it at any good, radical bookshop.
How about bad radical bookshops?
Well, you know, what if you like.
Yes.
There are a number of bookshops in Melbourne that have it available. So, yeah.
Can people buy it directly from you on the net? Have you got a web page?
Well, Kembla Books is Alexander and Mel. They set right, that publishing right. company up.
Right.
And they're the publishers.
Yeah.
And so I have my blog, but you can't buy it from the blog, but you can get it from the...
How do people access your blog?
So my blog is revoltsnow.wordpress.com.
So revolts with an S, now,
yeah,
one word.
Now, right. Yeah, right. .wordpress.com.
.wordpress.com. And if you're looking for Nick Southall, it's Southall.
That's correct.
Right. Look, for a pommy bastard, you've done pretty well in this country. So I'm pleased that your appearance brought you across, and I wish you all the best for the future, and hopefully there will be a sequel to Disaster Communism sometime in the near future.
Yeah, well, you never know. There is another book coming out next year, hopefully, that Mark Gorn and myself are working on at the moment. So,
can you give us a taste?
Look, it's called Crimes of Class.
Right.
So it's an exploration of regional and rural working class lives in informal and black economies, and about crime, class struggle, class composition, love, care, solidarity, and so forth.
Great. Thank you very much, Nick Southall. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much, Kelly Whitworth. Without you, there wouldn't be a program, and without you, there'd be no guests, because I'm just a lazy bastard who talks to people. Kelly does all the work.
Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly, and thank you, Joe.
No worries. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And thank you for listening to Radical Australia for the past hour and for tuning in to 3CR. Coming up next after these messages is Brainwaves.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.